At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
As a designer, you know clients want it all. A stunning site that runs their business and scales with their success. But tight deadlines shouldn't mean compromising your vision. Wix Studio is built for designers like you. Plan sites in seconds with AI-powered site mapping, then design, starting in Figma or in the Wix Studio Editor with precise layout tools. Then bring your vision to life with no-code animations, AI tools, and one-click responsive design. Design smoother and deliver sooner. Go to wixstudio.com.
I finally committed to getting back in shape. Hit the gym, ate clean, did everything right. But after 2 days, I felt drained. My body just couldn't keep up. That's when I found Stem Regen. It supports the release of my own stem cells to repair, recover, and actually rebuild from the inside out. Now I'm not just working out, I'm bouncing back. I feel stronger, more energized, and more like myself every single day. Stem Regen didn't just change my routine, it changed my recovery. Empower your body to recover from within, whether you are focused on recovery, longevity, or just overall wellness. Stem Regen helps your body feel the best it can. Release the best version of you. Try Stem Regen today at stemregen.co. Use code POD25 for 25% off your first order. Again, that's stemregen.co, code POD25.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey guys, welcome to Giggly Squad, a place where we make fun of everything, but most importantly, ourselves.
I'm Paige DeSorbo.
I'm Hannah Berner.
Welcome to the squad.
Giggly Squad started on Summer House when we were giggling during an inappropriate time.
But of course, we can't be managed.
So we decided to start this podcast to continue giggling.
We will make fun of pop culture news.
We're watching.
Fashion trends. Pep talks where we give advice.
Mental health moments.
And games and guests.
Listen to Giggly Squad on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical social, political, and economic liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. What's happened to Twitter, or now X, is the clearest example of why it's actually not great that so much of our digital communication is controlled by just a few firms, and, through them, by the whims of guys like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg. These single points of control not only mean a product we love today can be unlovable or just gone tomorrow, but also give more dangerous actors, like governments, avenues to use that centralization against us. The alternative is to revive what the internet once was, a decentralized and much more open place. I think this is really important, not just because it makes our digital communications less subject to arbitrary will, but also because it enables us to carve out communities for ourselves. My guest today wrote what is probably the most important essay about this need for decentralization, called Protocols, Not Platforms, which inspired some of the most exciting current developments, including Blue Sky. Mike Masnick is an expert in technology and technology policy and the editor of the indispensable blog TechDirt. He is also on the board of directors of Blue Sky. Reimagining Liberty is a listener-supported show. If you'd like to listen to episodes uninterrupted by ads from our sponsors, you can become a supporter. You'll get my newsletter ad-free as well. To learn more, head to www.aaronrosspowell.com. With that, let's turn to my conversation with Mike. Two things were on my mind as I was thinking about our conversation today and getting ready for it. The first was that the internet is a very different place from what it was like when I was a teenager in the 90s and a college kid in the late 90s and early 2000s and first getting into this stuff, in that it is It's much more centralized than it used to be. It's much more professionalized than it used to be. And it's controlled by primarily by a handful of large and influential corporations. And then the other thing was the episode of this show that I did last week was about the history of surveillance. And one of the things that I talked about with my guest, Pat Eddington, was the way that shifting technology has enabled the surveillance state to a degree that the various snooping sorts of decades ago could only have dreamed of. And I got to thinking about that in the context of our conversation today because it seems like those are somewhat related. And so what I want to ask you is, how do you think about tech in this current moment, about the internet in this current moment, and about this relationship between the internet as it exists today and which Blue Sky, which you're on the board of, is to some extent a response to? And we're recording this on June 13th as National Guard are still on the streets of Los Angeles and there's an authoritarian crackdown or attempted coup or whatever you want to call it happening. And a lot of this is being enabled by these same technologies that, you know, you've been following for forever now.
Yeah, that's a big question. especially as a starter.
I like to start with big questions and see how they go.
Yeah, no, it's good to think about these things. I think, the way the internet has evolved over the last 20, 30 years, depending on how you look at it or where you want to put the starting point, is worth thinking about for a variety of reasons. And, you know, the promise of the early internet was very much in the fact that it was a decentralized technology and it was an enabling technology that allowed people to do things that they wouldn't be able to do before. And I've talked about this in one context before, which I think is important and useful to think about, which is that, you know, in the pre-internet times, if you wanted to be heard, if you had something that you wanted to say and you wanted to be heard by a wider audience than just those around you, which might be family, friends, neighbors, whatever it might be, those at the local pub or whatever, you would have a lot of difficulty doing so. You needed the support of an intermediary who was basically positioned as a gatekeeper, and in that they rejected probably 99% or more of the people who wanted to speak through them. So that could be the radio station, the television station, the movie studio, the record label, the news publisher, newspaper publisher, radio broadcaster, book publisher, whoever it might be. These were the intermediaries who made it possible for people to speak. And it was very difficult to get through that gate. They were gatekeepers in the traditional sense. They had a very, very narrow slice of content that they could allow to reach a wider audience, and they were extremely selective, for better or for worse, in doing so. The rise of the internet sort of flipped the table on that and completely changed the way it worked, in that most of the speaking that people could do was without anyone acting as a gatekeeper at all. And there were tremendous benefits. And these were the things that those of us who have long been sort of supporters of internet technology were excited about and talked about and thought about as sort of the promise of the internet, that it allowed people who wouldn't have otherwise had a voice to have a voice. And that's super powerful. And there are lots of voices and that weren't heard before that were turned out to be very important, you know, to be able to have, let them have voices and to allow them to speak and to allow them to, you know, allow people to learn about the things that they wanted to talk about. And I think that has, you know, really been incredibly helpful in lots of ways that we often now forget. And it's tough to think back to the pre-internet times and realize like how many voices that we hear today and how many different perspectives and different ideas and different concepts that became mainstream really, really quickly wouldn't have been possible pre-internet. That said, you know, not every voice is helpful and not every voice is, you know, productive or pro-social or however you want to think about it. And it didn't take too long for people to begin to realize like that they could make use of these same technologies for less pro-social reasons and, you know, looking for ways to exploit it and to take advantage of it. And so that was inevitable. That was always going to happen. Certainly people raised those concerns from early on and some people were aware of them. What I think turned out to be somewhat surprising and what I think we're hopefully getting to a point where there's now some backlash to, was that in the interim, between those two periods where we viewed the internet one way and then now we sort of view it in a different way, was that a bunch of these intermediaries who were incredibly successful, who sprang up to sort of provide the tools to enable so many people to speak and to reach others and to do other things, that they themselves became a different kind of gatekeeper, not the traditional gatekeeper of the publisher or the newspaper or the movie studio or the record label, but rather a gatekeeper where, because so much speech went through these few funnels where the information could flow, that they then became targets for governments, for public pressure campaigns, for the companies themselves. And so we're in this world now where, you know, I sort of bristle when people say, oh, there's so much censorship today, because I don't think that's true. More people can speak than ever in more places than ever. But we have built this world where a lot of people are really, really reliant on a few companies that are deeply centralized and create clear choke points for information, and those choke points have become targets. They become targets of governments. They become targets of billionaires. They have become targets to control for that very reason, and sort of recognizing that those choke points become incredibly valuable and incredibly important. And that is the thing that, I think is where, you know, we've run into problems with how the internet works and why I'm sort of so excited about trying to move the world back to more decentralized tools where they are back to that original promise of being, you know, purely enabling tools without the easy choke points.
What does that alternative look like? Because I can imagine someone listening to that and saying, well, but the reason that we ended up in the world that we have right now, with these handful of companies controlling the medium on which most of us communicate, is because it works better. We like it better. Mm-hmm. It was great to just know that every person I could imagine was on Facebook and I could connect to them, as opposed to having to find which weird web forum or which instant messenger they were on, although we all have like 36 chat apps on our phones right now. And then two, one of the reasons they were able to provide that is because you can make a lot of money aggregating everybody. Those web forums that we hung out in the 90s didn't tend to make much money, and they didn't have a lot of people, and they couldn't have scaled up to 300 million monthly users or whatever those numbers are. So this always seems to be when I talk with people about various open or decentralized tech, there's often a response of, that sounds really neat. Like, I can see why it sounds exciting and so on, but is this going to be like trying to use desktop Linux or using GIMP instead of Photoshop, or, you know, like the experience, you're asking me to have kind of a worse experience online to get this stuff that like matters to you and seems kind of cool to me, but, you know, my grandma doesn't care.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is the right discussion to have and the right concerns to raise, right? So there are a few reasons why we went from that original promise to this world that we're at now. And one huge part of it was certainly the convenience factor, right? The reason why these few companies have become so successful and so big was mainly that they took the annoying parts of the internet and made them so easy that your grandmother could use them. And that's wonderful, right? I mean, that's, you know, one of the most amazing things of the internet was the fact that, you know, everyone could use it and everyone could reach this content. I mean, I still recall my grandmother has long since passed away, but before that happened, she had gotten a web TV. She did not have a computer, but she had gotten a web TV, and she would tell me that every night before going to bed, she would call up TechDirt and scroll through it, and she wouldn't understand anything she was reading, but she had to read it. And you know, that's you know, the sort of wonderful nature of you know, an internet that anyone can use is that it, you know, it creates all of these like very nice opportunities. The you know, the other aspect of it, and this is where a lot of people have raised concerns, is that when you become that choke point, it also means you get to extract significant revenue, which is the second point that you were raising. And, you know, that became very important. These companies are all, you know, for the most part, all public companies. They have, you know, Wall Street and you know, different hedge funds and different, you know, bankers controlling the stock and on their boards and demanding ever-increasing returns. And they have certainly tremendous pressure to you know, make the numbers go up, which is, you know, sort of the nature of having, you know, public markets. And so it becomes very, very tempting if you're a company that has more and more control over the key choke points to use those key choke points to create toll booths of some sort, right? Those toll booths maybe don't look like traditional ones. But, you know, what we've seen certainly with Google and Meta in particular is that they were able to use the fact that they had that choke point control, were able to collect a lot of data to then sell advertising. And I want to be clear, because a lot of people say, oh, they sell data on people, but that's never actually true. They're selling advertising. They're using the data to target the advertising. And they're able to do that in a way that makes most users' overall experience worse, which is the opposite of how they started, right? They started by making the overall user experience better. But as they gained more and more control, they began to realize that that control allowed them to make user experience worse without and make themselves more and more money, sort of, you know, extracting more and more of the value that they're creating. They extract more of it for their own profits rather than providing more and more value for the users. But the only reason they're able to do that is because there isn't enough competition or there is an easy exit for the users of these technologies. So people are sort of brought in because it's convenient and useful and your grandmother can use it, and then they can't get out. And because of the increasing demands from these companies that have already extracted tremendous value from that end of it, they begin to sort of squeeze the different players. This is the thing that Cory Doctorow has talked about a lot in terms of what he refers to as inshittification, the process where, you know, at first they're good, but then once they have you, they begin to squeeze the users to extract more value. Then they move on to starting to squeeze their business partners to extract more value. And the overall experience is worse and worse, but because people can't exit, they sort of have a hold on you. The idea with decentralized systems is twofold. Can we build a world in which the experience is as good as the, you know, the centralized social systems? And in fact, can we build a world that is even better? You know, you can look at, people say, well, you know, these systems rose up in the first place because they provided that better experience. And so, you know, how could a decentralized system provide an equivalent or better experience? But the reality is that, you know, we didn't know, you know, in the early days what that better experience was like. We didn't know how to create a really simple, straightforward process for you know, users to onboard. And we sort of, you know, people came up in the early days sort of expected the world to, oh, you have to fiddle with these settings and get these drivers and all that kind of stuff. But now we realize, now we see like, oh yeah, like you make the process as simple as possible and then people will come. And so I think now we have the hindsight benefit of being able to look at what does it take to make a really easy service for users that they don't have to think about the complexity. But the thing that we can also do now that where we can sort of build a hybrid between these things. So build a front end that feels as simple and as usable as any of the traditional centralized services, but by building it in a decentralized open protocol way, expose the other side only for the people who care about it. Most users don't need to know about it at all, but the people who do can now build freely on it. Because the problem we had before was that if someone wanted to build on Facebook's platform or Google's platform or Amazon's platform or whatever, those companies had full control and could limit what you could do and often were very quick to shut down anything that they felt was competitive in any way or that they, you know, they wanted to create their own version of it and sort of shut you out. That we have that story over and over again, sometimes using the law against people, sometimes using other kinds of tricks, sometimes buying out the people, sometimes just, you know, changing their technology to cut off people, all of these different processes. Whereas if it's built in a way where the plumbing is exposed on purpose and can't be taken back, then we can start to see the experimentation. And so the thing that where I think it gets exciting is that when you do that, people begin to experiment. The first round of what, and this is kind of where we are right now, is everyone is sort of recreating the centralized platforms on decentralized infrastructure. So we have Blue Sky, which looks very much like a Twitter, right? You know, someone has now created Skylight, which looks very much like a TikTok. There's one, which I'm blanking on the name, that looks very much like an Instagram, which is, you know, similar to TikTok in some ways. People are building things that look quite a lot like what was there before. And so, you know, that's how like these kinds of innovations tend to work. The first thing you do is recreate the old thing. But then over time, you begin to realize like, oh, wait, like there's something else that we can do here. And the fact that people are decentralized and the fact that these systems are decentralized but can talk to each other clearly, maybe that opens up new opportunities and maybe there are new things that can be done. And nobody can predict ahead of time like which experiments are going to take off and which ones are like the breakthrough, the killer app, the thing that is the aha moment. But the difference is that when Facebook wants to innovate and do something new, it has to be like Mark Zuckerberg deciding we're going to pour $50 billion into the metaverse, or we're going to, you know, build Threads. Like it's a decision from on high that this is the thing that we are going to do. And so sometimes he's right, often he's wrong. And that's true of any of the big companies. You know, there has to be a top-down decision that this is what we're going to work on. What we get to with an open system like the App Protocol is that we can see all sorts of experimentation. And some of it is silly and jokes and toys, but some of it is serious. And because it's all just experimentation and it's not top-down driven, Blue Sky is not making these decisions at all. Blue Sky has no say, has no knowledge of these things. People are experimenting and doing different things. And when you get that widespread experimentation, I think you begin to discover stuff. Plenty of stuff is going to fail, but it, you know, that's the actual, you know, that's how we learn what actually works because there's so much more widespread thing. I'd had this conversation years ago, and it sort of relates to this in that there's like, you know, for a while the tech industry really, really talked up the value of like open systems and sharing of knowledge and all of these things. And then you looked at Apple and it was like the exception to that rule in that, you know, Steve Jobs kept a very, very closed system. Everything was secret. You know, there was no partnerships for the most part. And so I tended to think of it as like the difference between dictatorship and democracy in some sense, where you can have a benevolent dictator. It's entirely possible. They exist to some extent. At the same time, democracy can be very messy and sometimes slow and sometimes takes multiple steps backwards, sometimes gets things really screwed up. And it's messy. But I have to believe that in the long term, because of the experimentation that democracy allows for and the sort of openness of the system, you tend to move towards better things in the long run. Whereas even if you have a benevolent dictatorship that does some great things up front, over time, they tend to fail just because of all of the natural incentives of those who are in charge to create problems. And so we're in this world now where we have a bunch of dictatorships, whether or not you want to consider them benevolent or not is totally subjective. And we have this sort of very messy, more democratic process, which is not quite there yet, but is allowing for more openness and more experimentation that I think in the long run has to, you know, has to create tremendous value because it allows for these experiments and we're going to figure out what works and what takes over. All that said, I never got to answer your question about the monetary aspect of it, which is an important aspect of this, but is also one that I think is still in the experimentation phase. And there has been a fair amount of talk about it where, you know, can we create systems where money follows value? As we're creating value for people and as you know, other services are creating value, traditionally, there are ways that you can create, you know, ways to get paid for value in ways that feel acceptable as opposed to feel extractive. That it's reasonable, you're getting some value and therefore you're willing to pay for it rather than I have no choice, but I have to pay for this because, you know, I've been sort of suckered into it. And so that is one of the things that you know, Blue Sky and certainly other decentralized platforms are still experimenting with. But again, it's not just us that's experimenting. There is this open system, and we've already seen, like, there's a third-party service called Graze Social that allows people to create their own custom feeds that then appear on Blue Sky. So it's an at protocol-based system that has a very, very nice interface for creating custom feeds. And they have introduced an advertising model within those feeds. So if you create a feed and lots of people use the feed that you created, you can turn on advertising. People can buy ads within your feed. You get some money. I think Graze gets a cut of it. That's part of their business model. So we're beginning to see some experimentation on the monetization side. I would like to believe that there are ways to make that work. The follow-up question, which I may be jumping ahead in terms of like where you are on that, is like, will you get to the point that those kinds of services can extract as much money as the centralized services? And the answer is, I don't know. I can be optimistic that if we can build much more value and we can unlock a ton of value by being open, by allowing experimentation, that eventually that will come true no matter what. But at the same time, you know, I think we're in a better place where the you know, if the overall system is open and the value is more widespread, is more democratic, is more, you know, moved to the edges because the services is that way, I think that's a better world overall. So even if, you know, no individual company becomes as valuable as some of these centralized services, I still think that they can be both incredibly valuable, incredibly profitable, and building a better system overall than just focusing on extracting as much money from people who are sort of sick of using the service but feel locked in.
I'm thinking about the intransigence in the face of the, I think, very positive vision you just set out, because we're in another round on Blue Sky of discourse. Yes. Of journalists who are still on Twitter popping in occasionally to gripe about how much they don't like it on Blue Sky and then leave to go write an article about the nasty replies that they get. And it's baffling to me because Twitter in particular is like a perfect example of the risk of the world that we're in right now and the risk that the decentralization exists in part to mitigate against, because it was a service lots of us loved And it was, Twitter was never terribly well run. There were lots of problems with it, but it was like, it was a fun place, right? And many of us spent, and we made all sorts of like genuine friendships there. Yep. And it was great. In addition to having all sorts of awful stuff that was going on. And so we all get that. And the value of like having a platform that you can rely on, like that was part of it, was you knew that everyone was there and you knew that you were building this network and so on. And then it got bought and it changed very, very quickly. And everyone saw that. And I don't think like the journalists who say Blue Sky is just kind of like weird nerds and people who don't have a sense of humor or something, are like, they recognize that Twitter has changed. I don't think they recognize how much it's changed because they're stewing in it all the time. But for some reason, they don't want to switch. And a lot of it seems to be that, like, Twitter is this real thing. Like, to be real and professional is to be that old world. A billionaire owns you. You're backed by, you know, huge sums of VC dollars. You're extracting, that the enchantification is kicked in. Like, that's kind of a sign of you've made it. And whereas something like the App Protocol is perplexing to most people, ActivityPub, which runs like the Mastodon network, is perplexing to most people. But that's what's like led with is come for the decentralization. And it just seems like it's people have this, they've lost this ability to view the internet as this weird experimental place where you can try out different things. And they're like, no, this thing is professionalized.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick with it, even if it's increasingly awful.
Yeah. I mean, a few responses to that. So first of all, I would counter the idea that Blue Sky leads with the decentralization and the protocol aspect of it. You know, the company, and I should be clear. I probably should have said this up front, but I'll be clear here. I'm speaking on my own behalf. I am on the board, but I'm certainly not speaking for the company. And, you know, as a board member, I have a lot less say in what happens with the company than people believe. But, you know, I'm sort of a deeply involved advisor, I think would be the better description of what I do with Blue Sky. But I think Blue Sky, and this was very deliberate in how they looked at it, was that they didn't want most people thinking about the underlying stuff. This was a problem, I think, with Mastodon, where, you know, from the get-go, it was very important that people bought into the ideology of decentralization. Just even in the fact that you initially had a pick from a long list of servers, and that was very confusing. From the very beginning, Blue Sky made it clear that they wanted to, you know, as I was talking about earlier, they wanted to have this experience that felt just like the centralized experience, so that if you don't need to know about the decentralized nature of the protocol beneath it, you don't have to. You don't have to ever think about it. And I think that's the right decision, because for most people, that doesn't matter. But the fact that it is there, and the fact that there is this experimentation going on, and the fact that there are other things happening, do matter in the long run. They just don't matter for everybody to know about it in the first place. In terms of the people who are sticking with X now, and sort of refuse to come over, there is this just natural element of momentum, you know, and inertia, right? Where it's like, God, that's a process. To recreate your social graph. And, you know, there are some tools now where you can find the same people and do these things. But, you know, part of the reason, and certainly part of the thinking behind Blue Sky and the At Protocol, is that, you know, if you are using At Protocol, I shouldn't even say Blue Sky at this point, if you're using At Protocol, that should never be a worry again, because if Blue Sky turns bad, if Blue Sky gets taken over by a billionaire who wants to destroy it in pursuit of political power, everybody can leave Blue Sky without having to go through the process of recreating their network, because the App Protocol is effectively independent of the company itself. So it can be recreated entirely without Blue Sky's involvement. That creates some incentives too for like that not to happen to Blue Sky, because they know that they could lose all of their users very quickly, and they could recreate without having to, you know, just sort of automatically recreate without having to you know, have each of the individual users make separate decisions around it.
Breezeline's limited-time power deal on internet and mobile is here. Get blazing fast internet for $19.99 per month when bundled. Plus, add a mobile line and get one on us. It's the power couple your wallet's been waiting for. Visit breezeline.com today.
You're a professional web creator who needs a platform that works as hard as you do. Wix Studio is built for you, whether you're a designer, developer, or marketer ready to amplify your impact. Build intuitively with advanced design features and AI-powered tools. Manage your clients and projects efficiently from one workspace. Scale with dynamic systems and fully managed infrastructure. Create exceptional websites with hyper-efficiency on Wix Studio.
But I think that's an important point that in theory, we're still in the testing phase of this. In theory, you know, using Blue Sky should not have to go through this experience again of a shakeup of a terrible owner doing something really bad to the platform. And then suddenly it's like everybody has to go, oh no, now I got to start again. And a lot of people will be too lazy and they won't start again. You know, if we can make it as easy, and this is where it's getting to, where it's basically, I don't trust Blue Sky anymore. Click a button here and used to have all of your content, all of your followers, everything that you're following, and you're just no longer touching Blue Sky hardware. That's where we're going. And I think that is important. The other aspect of it is this weird feeling. This is part of the discourse now about the idea that like, oh, you know, there's sort of a cultural aspect to what is happening on this platform or that platform that I think is weird. Like, I can't quite describe, you know, there is this aspect of, yes, Blue Sky's community tends to be more left-leaning than X's. Like, there's no, like, yeah, I mean, that's obviously true. It doesn't need to be that way. People could certainly come in and use at protocol. They could, you know, anyone can use it. And if people wanted to, they could create their own. Like somebody could create MAGA Sky on at protocol if they wanted to. There's nothing stopping that. And, you know, anyone is free to do that. People might react in different ways. But there is this element of, you know, people keep talking about like echo chambers or bubbles, which I think is really inaccurate. And I've always thought that the arguments around echo chambers and bubbles were inaccurate. And there were some studies a few years back, I'd written about this. And so I don't remember all of the details and I might get some of the specifics wrong, but there have been some academic studies that were looking at this idea of echo chambers and bubbles. And they sort of suggested that, you know, the narrative was very different than the reality. And that the reality was that in your everyday life, you know, the people around you, the people you worked with, the people in your city or town or village or wherever tended to be more ideologically similar to you than the people that you interacted with online. And in fact, you were more likely to get a diversity of viewpoints and a diversity of ideas interacting online. And sometimes the argument was, I think, again, I'm paraphrasing, and this is a few years since I read it. The argument was effectively like people seem to, the narrative sort of sprung up in part because people were reacting to the fact that they would go into these online communities, encounter ideas that they were not used to or that they felt uncomfortable with, and then sort of get angry about it. And so there was more of like, a sort of chemical reaction of like, ooh, you know, like this, you know, shocks me in a way that causes me to react. And that has sort of like played up some of the culture war aspects of things, which then made people respond by sort of banding together with friends and effectively doing battle, you know, between different ideologies and everything. And that led people to talking about, you know, bubbles and echo chambers, even if the reality was they're actually, you know, experiencing more diversity of ideas and opinions. But I think the larger point is that when people gather, there's always going to be some sort of community aspect and cultural aspect of what people are gathering around. In some cases, it's really explicit. You look at a site like Reddit, where you have communities developing around particular topics. But then you have, you know, the sort of larger general purpose chat rooms, whether it's, you know, Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or Blue Sky or Mastodon or whatever. And, you know, cultures sort of evolve somewhat naturally. And it's not because there's a bubble or an echo chamber, but rather that this is the culture that has developed. And with culture comes norms, and with norms come, you know, the sort of social pressure in one way or another. And that's true on any one of these platforms. If you are acting in a way that, you know, there's different things that you can do wrong. You can certainly do things wrong that cause you to violate the terms of service of a platform and get, you know, dinged in some ways, whether it's limited or suspended or banned entirely in extreme cases. Or you can get sort of social response. And sometimes the social response is friendly, where people are like, hey, we don't do that here. And sometimes the social response is, you know, a little bit more aggressive. And I think that's just sort of the nature of all online communities. And those communities change over time. I mean, I've been obviously on Blue Sky since very, very early on. And I would even say that the nature of the community and the culture there has changed a lot in terms of, you know, what sorts of cultural norms people were talking about in the early days and tried to enforce are very different than the ones today. And I would imagine, despite this, you know, we have this sense that what it is today is the way it's always going to be, that's going to continue to change. You know, right now, I've pointed this out, you know, in a not less, I was going to say non-culture war way, but this is less of a culture war. You know, I'm a fan of artificial intelligence tools, and I play with them and use them and try and use them in productive ways. There is a general sense among many people on Blue Sky that the LLMs and other generative AI tools are pure evil, completely useless, and a complete waste of time and money and resources. And so every once in a while, I decide that I will talk about some experiment that I'm working on using one of these tools, and I will get very aggressive responses. Not always a pleasant experience, but you know, it's an interesting experience sort of learning the sort of cultural norms that some people have there. Increasingly, I've seen that more and more people are saying, no, actually, like, we are interested in this, and we see that you're using it in good faith and you're trying to talk about it in good faith. And so I've been getting more and more people responding to me saying, hey, I actually, you know, I find this interesting. There's still some people who yell about it, but I feel like, you know, this is one area where the culture is beginning to shift and you're beginning to see things. But the other aspect of it too is that the nature of Blue Sky and the way it is structured to be totally open and to provide different tools that you can use to sort of curate your own experience, whether it is, you know, more powerful blocking tools, but also lists and labelers, which are sort of third-party moderation services that are now that anyone can build their own moderation services that I've started to make use of. Like, you're able to sort of craft the kind of community and kind of experience that you want in a way that was never possible and never really could be possible on a Facebook or a Twitter. And so, you know, the experience is jarring for some, in part because it's just slightly different cultural norms. It's just the way it has developed. But the tools are there that allow people to sort of craft the community that they want and the experience that they want. The stumbling block and where things need to get to is for those tools and the ability to do that to become as easy as everything else, and for people to realize, like, oh, you know, if I want to be comfortable on Blue Sky, I can do these like three things, and then everything comes in place. And we're starting to see that, like, starter packs was a huge thing that Blue Sky created, which allowed people to go on Blue Sky and anyone could create a starter pack on a topic or friends or whatever. And it's just like a list of people you should follow. It just made it really easy for people to come in, find a bunch of really good people on a particular topic, and follow them all and start to increase the people that we're seeing. We need more of those kinds of tools for things like the labeling systems and the third-party moderation and, you know, third-party apps and tools and services and custom feeds. I think the company will get there, but, you know, making it so that people realize that they're in control, which leads to one more thing. I know I'm sort of rambling on at great length, but one more point I'll make on this is that, you know, one of the downsides, I think, of the last 10 to 15 years of social media was the fact that it, you know, because it was controlled by centralized systems and, you know, by, you know, billionaire owners of these companies who have a very strong incentive to extract more value, make the numbers go up for Wall Street, users sort of built out a kind of learned helplessness, is what I've referred to it as, where they realized, and this is where part of some of the anger comes from for some of these services, they realized that there was nothing that they could do. They didn't have the power to make changes themselves. And therefore, if they wanted to change something or fix something, their only real thing to do was to yell. And they could use the platforms that they were on, that they were complaining about, to yell. But they would yell at the people who work there. They would yell at the, you know, CEO, the billionaires who owned it. Or maybe they would yell at the government and say, can you please force this site to change in the way that will make it better for me and my friends or whatever. And it's just been sort of built into an entire generation of people that if you don't like the system that you're using, your only recourse is to yell. And I think we have to get people back to the idea that, like, with things like Blue Sky and App Protocol, but also Mastodon, also some other platforms, I don't want to leave those out, you have a lot more power now to actually make change, to build the systems yourselves. There's, you know, settings and tools. Some of them are third-party tools, or people can build their own tools to then go in and make the place better yourself. But just a lot of people don't even think of that possibility because they've spent so long just yelling.
Yes, to all of that. One of the most popular articles that I've ever written was about Blue Sky and bubbles. Mm-hmm. And was about, even if Blue Sky is a bubble, that's okay. And what I was thinking about as you were just talking was, we had the incentive for the centralized platforms was just monthly or daily active users. It was just, yes, keeping that number going up. And we got to the sense that, like, what the internet needs is a place where everyone is. It needs the global water cooler. And that's a deeply weird thing, even, yeah, in like the history of the internet, that the internet used to be this weird, fractured geography of strange people doing strange things in strange corners, and you would find them and you'd find the handful of corners you liked and you'd hang out in them. And certainly everyone was not in one place. And at the time, if you described that, I think most people would have recognized it as, like, that's not actually desirable. Like, I don't want to be in a place with right, half a billion people, because I don't actually want to hang out with those people. Like, right, that's not all of those half a billion people are interesting to me. Many of them I don't like. They don't share the same interests. I want to hang out, which is what we do in our daily lives. Like, we find the people who share our interests, and we don't go and hang out with just a grab bag of absolutely random people.
Right.
And we're content with that. And in the media landscape, it used to be like, it would have been very weird to say to someone like, no, you have an obligation to subscribe to the New York Times because that's what has the most subscribers. And so you're actually like, it's bad for you to be reading the Denver Post or the LA Times right, or some alternative. We just had different sources we went to. And in the glory days of Google Reader, we aggregated those ourselves. And so it feels like this is...
You're a professional web creator who needs a platform that works as hard as you do. Wix Studio is built for you, whether you're a designer, developer, or marketer ready to amplify your impact. Build intuitively with advanced design features and AI-powered tools. Manage your clients and projects efficiently from one workspace. Scale with dynamic systems and fully managed infrastructure. Create exceptional websites with hyper-efficiency on Wix Studio.
There were bad reasons why we created the water coolers. And the people who are yelling at us to stay on the one water cooler tend to be the ones who, the strange few who really benefit from that, which is like the influencer big types who just, they want to maximize their own, see their own number go up. But that's not what most of us do. And we're not going to be broadcasters. We're not going to earn a living posting our opinions online. But what App Protocol does and others is both offers you the opportunity and to some extent through the tools you're just mentioning, kind of compels you to like create your own communities.
Yes.
And build the online experience that you want. And I want to say that's really important now too, because I think one of the things that like, one of the reasons I value Blue Sky right now, and I spend more time on it than I probably should, is I like the fact that there's a feeling of solidarity in this, like, we're in like a really troubling time. Yeah. And there is something about being in a place where, yes, I too get yelled at for saying nice things about AI or expressing kind of libertarian opinions on some matters. But by and large, it is like people kind of expressing a desire to fight back and like a hope that we can get through this together. And I wouldn't get that on Twitter.
Yeah.
And that's extremely valuable to like have a community. And I think that's what you're getting at is we can build, we can build those communities. We can shape those communities and not just have them be at the whim of a Zuckerberg or a Musk.
Yeah. I think you're exactly right. I think there's one more element to this that I think is important to think about if you're trying to sort of think through the implications of this, which is that, you know, you're certainly right that like the idea of like a universal water cooler or town square or whatever analogy you want to use sounds a little crazy when you begin to think about it. The early internet was not that. And I don't think anyone ever thought it would be. It was always like small focused communities, weird communities, you know, more mainstream communities. It was all communities. It was always news groups or chat rooms or like, you know, specific topic focused things. But the thing that was missing and what sort of social media and the idea of a social graph started to create was like this concept of like following and connection, which turns out to be really, really valuable and was totally missing from the beginnings of the internet. And so the problem was that we sort of overcorrected on that and overly focused on who controlled that social graph without realizing like we can create this sort of, you know, social substrate of like connections and following and communities, and then allow people to build their own communities on top of that, which has some really nice features where it's like, you know, if I want to spend time in a particular community, you know, pick your, you know, knitting or gardening or hiking or skiing or whatever it might be, you know, you can do that without having to like, if you have a sort of, you know, I don't want to say universal, but more widely accepted protocol that has social aspects to it, following and liking and things like that, you can begin to use that so that you don't have to sign up. You don't have to sign up for a new, new community to be in the knitting community or a new community to be in the, you know, hacker community, whatever it might be, but you can use this single identity, this single infrastructure to then take part in these different communities and, you know, build up culture around them. And I think that's where we have to head, as opposed to this idea of this universal, you know, water cooler. I mean, I've sort of said sort of half jokingly, like every time people refer to the digital town square or whatever, which is a nonsense concept if you think about it for more than 5 seconds. You know, if there were a digital town square, it's the internet itself. It's not any one property on it. And, you know, the Facebooks and Instagrams and TikToks and Twitters of the world are really sort of private stores around that digital town square, and you can sort of, you know, walk from one to the other, but they're still privately owned spaces. They're not really, you know, it's the internet itself that is the town square. And what the various decentralized protocols are doing, all of them, is really trying to build up infrastructure for that digital town square that then allow people to connect and communicate and to do things without being stuck in any one private property.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.
You're a professional web creator who needs a platform that works as hard as you do. Wix Studio is built for you, whether you're a designer, developer, or marketer ready to amplify your impact. Build intuitively with advanced design features and AI-powered tools. Manage your clients and projects efficiently from one workspace. Scale with dynamic systems and fully managed infrastructure. Create exceptional websites with hyper-efficiency on Wix Studio.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey guys, welcome to Giggly Squad, a place where we make fun of everything, but most importantly, ourselves.
I'm Paige DeSorbo.
I'm Hannah Berner.
Welcome to the squad.
Giggly Squad started on Summer House when we were giggling during an inappropriate time.
But of course, we can't be managed.
So we decided to start this podcast to continue giggling.
We will make fun of pop culture news.
We're watching.
Fashion trends. Pep talks where we give advice.
Mental health moments.
And games and guests.
Listen to Giggly Squad on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.